across the border, George. So will Australia. Australia isn't very good. In fact, they keep their foreign minister out there complaining about his ain't policy.
New Zealand. I wish you well.
We'd like to go now to the economy. And I've asked John Conlon to speak to this point. You all have been various briefings and so forth. John has made some very, very effective statements, including on the merits of which the nation, including also things
liberal type media people who really don't understand.
understand it, like it for the wrong reasons. They like what we did, but they're petrified at the thought that we did it, and that it might help us politically. And so that is why you see in some of the media an enormous turning movement in which they are joined by, of course, the Democratic leadership, and so I don't blame them. They should be doing exactly what they should be, kicking our brains out on the economy, because they got to have some issue, just as we Republicans should have been kicking their brains out, and did in 61, 62, and 63, about unemployment. We did a little. We had a little committee called Structural Unemployment. The rest of them, I don't know, I'm not laying right to them about why are we getting the country moving again and all that sort of thing. But now we come to the point. Here's what the media now zeroes in on this question. So what happens is that the impression in the country is that the country today is in a deep recession, or if it is recovering, it is not recovering significantly. Now, as a matter of fact, when we look at recovering, as John will point out, you just listen to his figures, I think you'll bear it out. You look at recovery. When you look at the upward movement, it is strong, it is wide, and it's very deep. And it's moving upward, and the prospects are good. But in order to get this across, it requires on the part of the administration a very administration, and to the extent we can get some of our Republican congressmen and senators to stand up rather than just to bitch all the time, and to stand up with us rather than to join the other side, to stand up and say, all right, this is what they did. They never had prosperity with peace signed. And we are not going to have prosperity based on war. And I just make the final point that I made in press conference just today. Approximately 2 million men, I've said it many times around this table, but now it's up to 2 million, are out of the armed forces or defense plans since we came into office. Now, if those 2 million men were still in the armed forces, still in defense plans, unemployment would be 4.3% today. And we'd be having 350 casualties a day, a week, instead of 11. Is it worth the price? Now, that's a political argument. You have to get political. But we got some good economic argument. Here's your answer. Okay. I didn't even take the ripple in. The ripple is much bigger. John, so give us a little lecture.
Well, let's start on the question. In the interest of time, I know we're running
over time.
We're running out of time. And at the risk of being repetitive on some of the figures, which you all know, the president has postured the problem in the absolute of the proper context. The political enemies, both in and out of office, the so-called economic statesmen, the economic spokesmen, in the academic world and the business world, labor and others who, and particularly the press, who want to be critical, can no longer do so in the international field because of the very things the vice president's been talking about, the bill's been talking about, the president's been talking about. They had the rug pulled out from under them. So they have no place to concentrate except in the economic front. Now, what are the facts? Well, there happens to be some good news and some bad news. There's no question about that. And I think at the outset, we ought to, this month, as you're after for that matter, treat this subject with absolute and complete candor. No point in trying to kid ourselves because you don't kid anybody else. They see through it. We hurt ourselves more than if we said nothing. So we have to recognize that we do have some problems. But for those who see nothing but gloom, and Bob, I include some of your senators who put it on themselves to seem to create a situation where they reflected total lack of confidence in the economy, in the country, and particularly in their own party, which to me wasn't even a smart thing to do. But they want to say that everything's gone to hell in a handbasket. Why has it? There's 78.4 million people working in the United States today. Now, they're working at the highest salaries, the highest wages ever in the history of the United States. Now, their savings are at an all-time high. Everybody says we're in a recession. How the hell do you get in a recession with almost 80 million people working at the highest salaries and wages with the greatest amount of savings they've ever had? And they say, well, there's no confidence. Consumers have no confidence. Well, do they or don't they? Read your morning paper. The automobile sales this morning were almost at an all-time high in the history of the nation. One figure that you saw reported was the second highest in the history since 1968, the all-time high. Another figure that was reported was the third highest ever in the history of the United States, second only to 68 and I believe 65. Now, they're spending, consumers are spending at the rate of $33 billion last year. That's an all-time high. Now, they talk about the leading indicators. Now, out of the last 8 months, the 12 leading indicators have been up. They talk about, again, the fact that there's no confidence in the economy, yet, just read you some statistics. You're spending retail sales. The first half of this year was running at the rate of 17.5%. 17.5% increase compared to 3.6% during the comparable period of 1970. Now, I would say that's some slight improvement. Now, they say, well, you made no progress on inflation. Well, we have cured inflation. Some of the elements of inflation are still there. But the truth of the matter is, the facts show that during the first 6 months of this year, we're running at the rate of 3.9%. Now that's compared to last year's 5.5%. So I submit to you, on any kind of a basis, on a percentage basis, or on an absolute basis, considerable progress is being made against inflation. Now if you want to look at it on the reverse side, one of the most compelling things that you have, looking at your inflation factor, is the GNP deflator. It's running now at the rate of 4.2%. Now that's the lowest it's been. That's reported on a quarterly basis. And that's the lowest it's been in 6 quarters. 4.2%. That's lower than it was in the first quarter. It's lower than it was any quarter of last year. So, your personal income, I said it was running at an all-time high. It's just at the rate of $870 billion. That's all. It is at an all-time high. Enormous figure. Savings rate, 1968, savings rate was 6.7%. For the in 1971, the second quarter was 8.4%. Now, these colonies turn this around on us, and they say, well, this is because they've got no confidence. They're saving all the money. Well, they're not saving it all. They're spending at an unprecedented rate. As I just told you, at the rate of 17.5% during the first 6 months. Unprecedented rate of spending is $33 billion. Now, we do have some bad news and durable goods. The durable goods knocked down, but it just all turned around simply because people are selling out their inventories. They're not building their inventories. Now, at some point, these tremendous retail sales have to show up in terms of new orders. Everybody says machine tool industry is in a state of great depression. It is bad. But let me read you some figures on machine tool orders and millions of dollars. In January, these are net new orders on machine tools. In January, it's 54 million, I'll round it. 54 million. February, it's 59 million. March, it's 68 million. April, it dropped back to 55 million. May, it was 71 million. And June, it's 88 million. Now, we've gone from 54 million in January to 88 million in June. And they said, well, there's no progress, no good news anywhere. Housing starts running at an all-time high, unprecedented, 1,982,000 last month. This doesn't include your mortgage loans, which now makes up an enormous percentage of your homes under $20,000. And they're running at the rate of about 462,000, on an annualized basis. So between the two, you're running at almost the rate of 2.5 million. Housing starts now. We potentially have some problems there. Depends on what the rate of interest does. Because it's a sensitive thing. The money supply, God knows it is. If economists believe in the monetary theory, the money supply has been pouring out at an unprecedented rate. Now, they all say that if there's about 6 to 9 months lag in the reaction to it. But that money supply during the first 6 months running at the rate of 10.3%, highest in the history of this country. And July was just as much, if not more. George, you remember what the figure was in July?
Over 10.
It's about the same. Now, so to be proud of in this economy. Now, this is not to say that you can't pick out some features of the economy and complain about them. Interest rates are going back up. And I think this is not a good sign. Our balance of payments are in damn bad shape. We all admit it. We all blame the Germans. We all blame the Japanese. We all blame everybody in the world except us. As we go around this country, just say we're going to cure it.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
We're going to do something about it. Now, in the final analysis, I think where we're caught is, one, the fact that we're not speaking up. Not enough of us are speaking up. Frankly, not enough of us have faith. I think the problem is basically a problem of psychology. Great. Many of our own friends are killing us. The business community is basically pessimistic, and they're talking. Their advisors are talking. Because everybody wants to be conservative. And when you combine your friends' criticisms and their reluctance and their fears of inflation with your natural enemies, you get a cage that you can't overcome. And I think there's a wave of pessimism sweeping in the country the last month. I think it was a higher degree of optimism 30 days ago than there is today. Now, I don't think you can get out and rail against it and just say it doesn't exist. There is a lack of cook. There is a lack of support. Great many people view it in terms of a lack of confidence. Well, my answer to that is, and I think our spokesman ought to be saying that the president who had the capacity, who had the understanding, who had the courage to in effect pull off a China deal, certainly has the capacity, the understanding, and the courage to do whatever's necessary in the economic field. My God, if nothing else, at least members of the own party elected otherwise ought to have enough faith in to say he's going to take whatever action's necessary. If you don't know a damn thing, if he can't prove anything, you ought to just take it on faith. And I don't know any other way to play the game. But apparently, none of the people want to do that. That's about the net of this president. I'll take a little more time.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
John, one of the things that I see come back when we talk about the figures of personal income, savings, or anything like that, they always come back and say, you don't give us the figures of anything. What about the personal income per capita? How about the savings per capita? The population of the country is constantly going up, so naturally these figures go up. What's happening to them per capita? How do you answer that?
George's.
Okay. Well, they're going up, and I think one figure that's worth watching, that I've watched over the years, is real income of production workers, where you take their wage and you take the inflation and then average it out per worker. So it isn't some gross number, but on your theory per worker. Beginning in about 1965, on through most of 1970, that figure sort of dilly-dallying around, went up a little, went down a little, and basically it didn't change at all. And I think that has been one of the reasons for this big frustration of what you see in collective bargaining, because wages have been going up rapidly, but they haven't been getting anywhere in terms of their real earnings. And in many of the bargaining sessions in the last 2 years, the workers have come into that on the basis of a three-year contract that's expiring, and where their real earnings were probably a little less than at the 3 years that started that contract. So you see that. Now, in the last year, particularly this year, but started last year, we have seen the first persistent rise in average real earnings per production worker, and that's covering some 50 million or so people. So it seems to me that is a figure for us to keep our eye on, and if that trend continues, I think that's an underlying thing of really great importance. Not what is happening to their money wages, but what's happening to their real wages after you take account of inflation. From 1966, approximately, through 1968, well, that was a period, of course, of low unemployment, you recall, because of the war and significant wage increases. And yet, American workers didn't gain at all. They were on a treadmill. They've been on a treadmill. They were on a treadmill in 69 as well. In 69,
significant thing that George is saying, and this is a very important point. This is the first time now in 5 years we've finally gotten the American worker, the wage earner, off the treadmill so that he, his real earnings have begun to do the loss, and not just his paper earnings.
I do check those figures, Mr. Vice President. I believe the accurate figures. I don't know what time span, but I'm sure that after inflation and everything else, in terms of disposable income, the American workers' income is up 1.6%. I believe that's the first half of the year.
And it's been 1 year to job. Compare that to the fact that it just hasn't happened for 5 years.
The reason I raise it, excuse me, Mr. President, is because when you use these other figures, then as soon as you're gone, somebody comes in and says they don't mean anything. We got good figures to use and they can't refute.
There are some other uses for some of that issue.
Yeah, sure. Mr. President, I just want to make this comment that I don't think there's anybody else on the national scene that can deal with this problem but you. And I have all the faith in your dealing with it that a man could possibly have. But on the other hand, this is an area where I've spent a lifetime, basically. And the hard facts are that the men in business and finance during the 60s knew things were not sound in this country and were moving in the wrong direction economically and have been concerned for years about the direction this economy has been moving in. And also recognize that we're confronted with some very unusual developments of a very fundamental character. I need to take our hand. 25% of those automobile sales are going to be foreign cars. And furthermore, there isn't a car company in this country that can compete head-on with a producer in Germany or Japan.
Particularly the small ones.
Well, even small ones.
I said particularly.
Yeah, particularly small ones. But I mean, even if they were producing the same type of cars, small cars, they can't compete head-on.
Well, that's what I meant to say, George. I understand. Exactly the same small cars that Toyota is $200 higher.
That's exactly that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Higher. Now, the men who are making economic decisions in this country of an operating character in the finance field as well as in the field of manufacturing and employment are convinced in the main that we have a new element in the economic situation to deal with that's not being dealt with. It's not being dealt with in this country. It's not being dealt with in any other country in the free world, and that's the cost push inflation. And consequently, they're making their decisions on that basis. Now, it isn't on the basis of just the figures here, because hell, if you only relied on business and figures in running a business, you'd never succeed. And any other thing, Mr. President, you've got a feel of the intangibles, and you know where things are moving. Now, I wouldn't be honest with you if I didn't indicate that as a man who happens to be responsible now for the housing aspect in this administration, who's been in the automobile business and been in some of these other things, that the people who are making the decisions don't believe that we're coming to grips with the problem of inflation, and they don't believe we're coming to grips with this cost-push situation. And that's why these jobs exist, and that's, in my opinion, why they're going to continue to exist until we have taken meaningful action in their terms to deal with. Now, I haven't voiced these sort of views publicly, and I haven't discussed them with people outside of New York. I've said what I said and what I've had to say here.
I don't disagree with that at all.
But on the other hand, I think we're confronted with a very grave situation, and I believe that whatever decisions we make here in the next 2 or 3 months in this area, the next 2 months almost, are going to make or break the administration. I think it's absolutely vital for you to be reelected, both in terms of the international situation, in terms of the domestic situation. But this economic situation can trip us up because of what people think. And I don't believe at this point, John, I just don't believe that going out and talking those figures is going to change these basic attitudes that
I think they're shaping the course of this situation.
That's very appropriate, and it's right on the mark. Here's what I am, all that I am suggesting is this, and I want to be quite direct with all the non-politicians and the politicians here. It's impossible to get this across to Republican leaders in Congress, because they have developed, with a very few exceptions, Mel knows, sort of an attitude with it against whatever administration is saying. I know that it's very difficult to use the president to sort of simplify our battle. They do a terrific job on some things. I must say, getting that Lockheed thing, too, was a master stroke, and I must say that all of you helped. I want you to know, I appreciate it. What we're handing out to you is a John on that, and the gym on railroads and steel, despite the fact that we didn't like the steel price rise, and nevertheless, it's a hell of a lot better than having the depressing effect of a strike, and then having a higher wage, because people could, when they were 1.5% points apart, able to not have taken them out on the strike, been out 60 days, and settled for what he had already settled for, and had to go up, I remember that before. Let me come to the key point. I am not suggesting that there is not a significant problem on inflation. I think there's also a significant problem on the wage price front, cost price push. I would point out that our problem on inflation, of course, is not one that's simply indigenous to America. The 22 countries in the OECD, I was surprised to learn that there are only three countries, little jackass countries for the most part, that have a lower rate of inflation than the United States. Now, that shouldn't give us too much comfort. The Japanese, the British, the Germans, the French, and all the rest are higher. But that's true. The Italians, of course. But they had a hell of a lot to catch up. Now, the second point I would like to make is that there are the problems. The second point I'd make, though, is this, that it is absolutely essential that we not get into the wicket of saying, well, this administration, after 2.5 years, has made the country in an economic mess. I think we've got to point out why this administration has won on down a war. So we're not killing 300 to 400 Americans a week in a war. We got it down to between 10 and 20, and we're getting out. And as a result of that, we have a problem on unemployment due to the war peace transition, period. And so they put them in, yeah, they'll cure unemployment. If you want a war, they cured unemployment with Korea. They cured unemployment with World War II. They cured unemployment with Vietnam. Do we want it again? And the answer is no. And don't ever just talk about their issue. Always get to our issue. So let's get that straight on unemployment. Also, let us point out that as far as unemployment is concerned, that we're going toward a goal that they never achieved. None of them achieved it. They didn't achieve it in the Roosevelt administration. At the end of World War II, there was a period between 66-67 when unemployment was lower. That was when, of course, millions were being kept in the armed services. And just as soon as they were out, up it went to head Korea. They never achieved high employment in peacetime. And we're going after that, and we're going to achieve it. As far as our unemployment is concerned, it is less than 6%. Too high, but less than 6%, and we believe, despite monthly aberrations, will go down, because it's got to go down as your economy goes up. Second point is, as we point out the things that are wrong, I think we've got to also keep in mind the fact that the economy is moving up sharply. You can't have a $52 billion increase in the GNP in the first half. You can't have retail sales, including housing, covering house, out of windows, and so forth, at near record highs. You can't have inventories in relation to sales at near record lows without having some eventual, George, you know better this fair enough, that you can't continue to sell without buying eventually. And so there will be some reaction. The economy will move upward. That is, however, does not get at the problem of inflation. It also does not get at the problem of psychology. Or I would point out that the psychological factor is very much in our hands, as well as in the hands of our opposition. You cannot allow people to be pounded day after day after day with just the critics. That means the media. It means actually our friends on the Democratic side. As I said, they ought to be on to kick our brains out. If we settle this, then they ought to kick us about busing. They will, or or something else, they'll find something, and that's the way the opposition should. I expect that. On the other hand, for Republicans and those Democrats that support us, and there are a lot of both, for us on the economic side to be purely defensive is nuts. We got to say, first, we are moving toward prosperity, high employment, in peacetime, something our Democratic friends, with all of their efforts, never were able to achieve. And thank God we are doing that. I make that point at the beginning, top level every time. Second point, I think we should then go on to say, we are concerned about inflation. And inflation, which meant that in the 5 years before this administration came to office, the American working man, in spite of record wage increases, gained nothing in real wages because it was eaten up. And now, for the first 6 months of the year, we find the American working man getting on with the treadmill, beginning to gain in real wages. Why? While we haven't made the progress against inflation that we would like, we've made some. And moving the rate from 4.5 to 3.9, or if you take another number, 5.9 to 4.1, whatever it is, it's some progress, and the result is that he's beginning to gain. Third point, this is the important thing. It is that we still, however, feel that unemployment is a major problem, we don't care, and that we're out to fight. We can kick the hell out of the Congress for getting out of here, as they will frighten, without passing the appropriation for the 150,000 jobs provided for the emergency thing. I mean, George Mann's done his part, but they're going to sit on it. They don't want us to have that money in August. They don't want us to get it until about the 1st of October, when it isn't going to be very important. Because that 150,000 jobs for those make-work jobs, money for those make-work jobs, really will help us most in the month of August with the teenagers and the rest. But this is what these guys are up to. So they're going to have a lot of gag around all over the world, doing exhibitions and a lot of weirdness. The other point that should be made on him, so we're fighting on the employment front. They're still sitting on provisions of HR 1, whatever we may think of other provisions, which provide 400,000 more jobs in the public service area, temporary jobs. This takes care of the teenagers and the others. This is where your high unemployment is. We also have a situation where we have, on the employment front, where we have a $43 million program, for example, for scientists and engineers. We have a program of jobs for veterans. Unemployment concerns us. We're working on the unemployment problem. And we are getting it down. We are going to get it down, and we're moving the economy up in other ways to get it down. On the inflation front, and here you come to the other thing that everybody is concerned about, that is, why not control us? I think the best line, and it's the line certainly that I take, is this, and despite the differences that have been mentioned between Burns, Arthur Burns, and myself, I mean, they're really matters of degree, not matters of principle. One, I am unalterably opposed, Arthur Burns is unalterably opposed, I hope everybody around this room is unalterably opposed to the Galbraith scheme, which is supported by the left-wing liberal Democrats and some jackass Republicans, of permanent wage and price controls. You've asked for permanent wage and price controls on America, and this country is finished. Finished as a major economic power. And they say, well, just pass it on the top 50 companies. It won't work. Permanent wage and price controls, with enforcement, with bureaucrats, with criminal penalties, will stifle the dynamic, quality of this economy. It will not work. That's perfect. Now, is there something in between? Well, at the other end of the spectrum, there is job building. That we are doing. Secretary of Labor is bringing to my attention every major negotiation that is going to be coming up. Thank God there are not too many, the way it's priced in. But the major ones will be brought to our attention. We're going to call them in. We're going to do everything that we can. And where government has any stroke, we'll use that stroke to keep those things within reason. We hope to do better in those. We are able to, for example, in the steel thing, where the stroke was not there because steel hadn't had a strike in 15 years. But at least we're going to do that on a specific individual basis. Then you come to the Burns proposal and the proposal of others. Why not a wage price board? It has some attraction, certainly a great deal of attraction from the standpoint of this standpoint. John Connors often made the point, I made it to you here. You can't say, gee, there is no inflation. It's coming along all right. There has been inflation. There
now. We have made some progress, but we need to make more. So that's why we're moving in on these individual settlements. That's why the construction thing, and while we haven't done enough, George, 9 to 10% is a hell of a lot better than 16%. That's some decrease. 18%. Well, whatever it is, at least some decrease. Okay. And we hope that more will come. But then, the wage price war, the real problem that concerns us, is not the, immediate announcement of it would be great. We could announce, say, from now on, there will be no wage increases and no price increases above 4%. So we'll get that out of the number. Or above 5%, maybe. Or above 3%. You're going to say, God, that's great. How do you enforce it? Well, the morality of the American businessman, the morality of the American labor leader, and their patriotism will enforce it. Never. They will not do it. At least that has been our experience. Now, for a while, public pressure would do it. So what we have to find here, George, and I think that's what you're searching for, what we are on, is a way where you can move, perhaps, in this area, short of a permanent wage and price controls, which God knows you don't want, I don't want, well, nobody wants, but which, in a way, which will jolt the American business community and the American labor community to a solid fact. They either stop the wage price push or the United States becomes a second-rate economic power.
That's right.
That's what we're looking at. So that's what we're looking at. We're becoming non-competitive of the world because of this. And that is another reason why we're going to have a very significant meeting prior to John's very significant meeting for the International Monetary Group on September 21st. The Productivity Commission's coming in here and we're really going to lay it out for them as to where this thing stands and what we have to do and to see what they can do or will do on a voluntary basis. Now, whether you go beyond that to a wage price board really depends upon whether the Congress and its hearings, we in our own councils, Arthur Burns and his suggestions, and he has yet to come up with a proposal that is specific in this respect, right? Whether they can come up with a plan which does not mean permanent wage price board, and which is enforceable without having the double-edged sword of going all the way to heavy criminal penalties on labor union leaders and on business leaders who violate. Now, we also, like his final statement, all these wage price decisions, there are not hundreds, there are not thousands. As you know, George Barnett, in to control the American economy, there are hundreds of thousands wage price decisions, predictive price decisions. I remember in OPA, my God, what was the size of the box of cornflakes? They had one little bitch down in the OPA that was figuring out, well, this size of cornflake, that should be that price, and this, that. That's great, you know, the cornflake should only charge as much for that. Otherwise, he goes to jail. That's why one of the reasons it became so unpopular at the end. And eventually, you get to that. The same with automobiles. Maybe it's fake leather or good leather. And if the car should be this or that, you went through the... I was just in tire rack. You ever know the differences in the qualities of recap tires?
Oh, yeah.
I know. Well, I'm telling you, that's a business. You think of all the crooked businesses, that is one. But how do you control it? Well, what I'm really trying to say is not to say there is no answer, because there is something else there. There may be a psychological answer. And we must, under no circumstances, get in a position to say everything is hunky-dory. It is not. But we also must get in a position of saying this country is on a disaster course. It is not. This economy is moving up. Unemployment has finally topped out at 6.2. It is less than 6% now. We believe it will continue to move on a downward path through the balance of this year and into next year. As far as inflation is concerned, that's our major concern. That is why, and this will be the last subject George will just cover very briefly, why we're going to fight to keep our budget down, why we've got to fight against the Congress that has already added 5.4 billion dollars to our 72 budget, and therefore has put it in imbalance insofar as it's as a full employment or full capacity budget is concerned. That is why in the wage price field, we're not sitting by. We're going to be activists. But on the other hand, we do not want to make a great big blow about something that will be ineffective. When we move, we want to be effective, because we can then have a great spurt to the hopes of businessmen and others to say, thank God the wage price spiral is over. And then when it failed, the frustration would eat us alive. So that's really what we're looking at. We're trying to find the right thing to do. And the Secretary's economy's exploring, Schultz, McCracken, Burns, the whole group. Is that a fair statement as to what we're discussing? In other words, remember, we're against inflation. We're against unemployment. We're particularly against, however, curing unemployment through another war, or continuing the one we're in. And we therefore believe that we have a program economically that the American people, and also we're against. I would hang this right on them, so I might as well build up. We're against what some of our Democratic presidential candidates have impliedly endorsed by failing to disendorse it, the Galbraith plan for putting the American economy in a straitjacket with wage and price controls enforced by criminal penalties, jail sentences, and so forth for every little corner grocery store.
Mr. President, why can't we turn this around on the, in the line of what you said in your press conference yesterday, that you weren't summarily rejecting the idea out of hand? And when they say wage price controls, why don't we say, well, let's see what you have in mind? In other words, let the Democrats send you with your statement that you're not automatically going to veto anything, if you'll consider anything logical.
Right.
And then let business and labor unions beat them over the head for their bills.
Good point. President, well, that's what the Secretary did. I would urge you to read, and John, circulate your piece, will you? Alex,
yes, sir.
Circulate the Secretary's statement of yesterday, because it's very short, illustrated to every member of the cabinet. I urge you to read it before you go home for August. It's a damn good statement. It raises exactly those points, Tim.
Mr. President?
Yes.
Can I say a word to the legislative branch? We are going to be gone. A lot of us be working very hard in August, and it's a good time for the executive branch to take the offensive, as John pointed out, on trying to build up the confidence, because all of us will be out of town, won't have the little daily press conferences, won't be in the Republican meeting, undermine the administration. So I would hope that while we're out of town, the executive branch would recognize it would be a good time to really build up the confidence in the administration. And secondly, when we come back in September, those who do, that some of our friends in the Senate and the House might be equipped to, in the first day of the, when we reconvene, to really take the offensive on the economy, and I think it might have a witty double-barrel impact. Because we have a lot of friends. It's just that
I say that John and I and others, but John and I particularly have had some long talks about weapons.
You will not be without weapons.
Mr. President, I just want to make one
final comment. The reason I believe you're going to straighten this aspect out is because you are against the things that won't
work. Yeah, right.
And you have got your eye on the things that have to be dealt with. And my concern is that we get on the
position where we're on the election, when we've taken the initiative, and where we've got a positive program to deal with those things.
And also, we've got
to be talking about it. Until we do, we're not going to counter this psychological problem, also the other. I think there are things that can be done.
It appears at the present time, first, that we are defending the status quo. Second, it appears, if we are defending the status quo, then the status quo is in a hell of a shape.
Right.
So, from a defensive standpoint, point out what the facts really are. All right, let's look what the facts are. Point out what the facts were in the previous administration. We know no prosperity without war.
That's
put it as cold as that. That makes the war issue, and it'll gut it. And then third, say, as far as we're concerned, we're not only looking for prosperity without war, but we're looking for prosperity without undue price inflation. And so we're going to fight this wage price thing. All Americans have got to do it. And but here's our program. The missing link, George, is to find the same program. But none of us should talk in terms of, well, everything's hunky-dory, it's going to come out, we don't give a damn. We care very much about unemployment. We care very much about the inflation thing. And we are developing programs, we're talking about it, we're anxious to hear their views. But let's not be so in terms of other things. Even our Republicans, a few of the jackasses, could have the good, at least if not the good sense, at least the grace, to say something positive about the foreign policy. They don't even do that.
So, we'll try to do a little longer. If you want to send a word to Georgia on the last subject, we'll be out here.
President, this gets right down into the guts of the management of government. And it goes right to the issue of a wage and price policy. What is our own wage policy within our own department in the way we're managing? I think we all know that the rate of increase in wage rates for government employees has been right up there with the construction people. And it represents a great problem. By this time, in defense, for example, 60% of the defense budget is payroll of one sort or another. Government is a very labor-intensive industry. There are all sorts of reasons for a rise in payroll costs. One of them that's directly subject to managers has to do with the average grade level of the people that you're managing. And here, you see an alarming picture. You take the general schedule employees. The average grade level was running in the neighborhood of 7.4, 7.3, 7.4, like that, through the 1960s. In 1968, calendar 68, it was 7.4. In 1969, it jumped to 7.7. In 1970, it jumped to 7.9. We don't have the final figures yet, but we think in, for 1971, in the fiscal year, it'll be about 8.1. So that's a very large increase in the average grade level of your employees. Now, it is a stunning fact that each tenth of a point, talking across the whole government, each tenth of a point is worth $175 million. So in going from 7.4 to 8.1, you see the cost impact of that, and what it does to the budget, what it does to your own ability to put forward the programs that you want. We talked about this with the president as we were discussing the general budget, and he directed us to get cracking and do something about it. And we have developed a program to work with each department. It's going to be a hard thing to get control of this, but nevertheless, it's just out of control at this point. It's killing us on the budget. We have a program for working with it. And we feel not only does this escalation at grade levels have to stop, we have to turn it around and knock it down. And we'll set up a goal for that. So this afternoon, you will get from me a memorandum that describes the background of this and sets forth the general program. Friday at 10:30, we're asking for a meeting with your undersecretary to go over it in some detail. And on Monday at 10:30, your administrative officers to come in and go over this and develop and start the developing a plan for the various departments. By September 15th, we feel that each agency and department should be able to have a program laid out that is approvable and that can be monitored and followed to turn this grade escalation down and get it going in the other direction. And we think that we ought to at least knock a tenth of a point off during fiscal 72, maybe more, and we want to work with you very hard in doing it. It's going to cause some difficulties, but the way this has been going, it's just outrageous. It varies a great deal between departments. Some departments don't seem to have a problem. Others are just, it's just incredible. HEW is incredible. Mr. Secretary, in the GS 11 to 15 has just gone wild in the last few years. Oddly enough, the O-line department, state, treasury, justice, don't seem to have too much of a problem. So it varies quite a lot. But we will be in touch with you, we'll be working with you, and we will be putting a lot of pressure on you. And there are two reasons for that. One is that there is a problem and we can do something about it in our own wage policy. The second reason is that the president
10% on this RIF business, I still got about 300,000 more people to go, and if I could get an exemption so that these guys could always knock off and still have to pay the high salary.
What do you see in that department is one of the first questions.
I don't see this process.
The airport is terrible.
Well, that's...
They just get rid of all the lower people, they never touch any of the top people.
Well, that's because of the RIF thing, you know. If we could get a 10% exemption on that, so we wouldn't, these top guys always RIF all the way down the bottom. So what you're doing is getting rid of your bottom people all the time. And every time you're cutting back in that department, we're ending up with these top people serving the bottom jobs.
Well, I think the answer is not to...
Get a national service,
but that gets rid of the top people as well as the bottom.
Yeah, but they've been there longer, and under the civil service rule, you can't fire them. They can go down and take a 7 job when they're a 10.
Well,
and
do you think we have ways of getting at that? When your people come over, we'll be prepared.
We can give it a 10%
exemption, and I do it. And I might say it varies quite a lot within the defense department as to how great this problem has been. The Air Force has just escalated terrifically. The Navy seems to, at least in the past, have had a pretty good grip on it. So it isn't uniform across the service.
Well, I can tell you the difference why that is.
But let me say that in conclusion that don't get the impression this is just those guys and over pressures for help, because the heat is on them and it's expected to be done. And it's total presidential back. And as far as old line departments are concerned, it may not be as bad there, but let's all set an example, White House staff included. Let me also say that there is more to come, and in terms of the whole employment situation, because the problems of budget surveillance and decree. Down again and again and again to a not always, but of course, basically the only way you get a budget is to take on a program. But in addition to that, it gets down to personnel. It's just saying that paper clips are turned on and the lights are all out of the personnel, and we're going to grapple with it, so that there will be no feeling when this personnel cut is announced, incidentally. There will be no exceptions this time. This is the way it's going to be. We have to do it and start to find ways within departments to work it out. It's going to be so hard actually on the old liners. This is going to be very hard on the new departments to throw like Ponzi for a variety of reasons. So just let me say that George, when he's sitting in this chair, he has to be opposing all this stuff. So when he gets in that chair, he's got to be for carrying it out and talk to Mal, of course, having in mind that that's the biggest department, and see if he can be reasonable. But you get it done. Okay, we're going to head to the people. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, present.
Three with your people again.
Very important.
Mr. President, you're right. Save your words for this.
Oh, excuse me. I thought you were going to say, oh, I didn't want to spend your time. About, say a word to the members of the cabinet as to how we set up this group, and then I'll give it its charge.
Unfortunately, we did not set it up. The Congress created a statutory monster.
I understand how we go through it. I'll ask because you know members of the cabinet just finished the cabinet meeting. You probably learned, well, what's this about? Is another White House conference, or is it something where we just have a meeting and then forget it after we say, can we provide food, or are we going to do something?
All right, tell us about the monster and we'll find out how we move. This is the second of the four meetings that we're required to have by statute. Under Chairman Rivera's leadership, we think that we move out immediately and have these regional meetings because you cannot. It's very difficult to recognize the constituency of the Puerto Ricans, Spanish speaking, and the Chicanos, and Cubans, and we want to go into the district offices and call the regional people together with assistance by the staff and from Mrs. Hitt, their field people. And we think those will be very productive, very helpful. This is one of the first things Henry wants to do.
You're going with me.
Yes, I understand.
Tell us a bit about your trip.
We've had one meeting. We had one region, already one session, a sort of trial one in San Francisco. You have all of the heads of all of these departments and the agencies, and we invited in students like Ms. Bader from, and I think we got a lot out of it. We learned a great deal, and then the whole name of the game is to upgrade the number of employees with Spanish speaking. Have a great number, but they're in the wrong places, and they're at the lower levels. We're trying to move them up, and I think thanks to Fred Malik, the board made a great deal of progress.
Thanks, Governor.
Yes, sir.
But now, what about activities outside of that?
No,
I'm making yourself to the government. Well, that's the charge. Go on beyond that.
I think our major effort thus far, we faced with, has been the bilingual program. I think in John's LEA program, we've done a better job of reaching the Mexican community. And that's where we can make the major impact within the government. Yes.
Well, let me say to the members of the cabinet that are here and their representatives, the representatives of other agencies like the Small Business Administration, the Civil Service Commission, and others who will be making decisions that will affect the members of this group that are here. Now, I have said this before around this cabinet table, and there has not been enough follow-through on it. The reason there has not been enough follow-through on it has been that there has not been from the media. There hasn't been enough pressure from the Congress. There hasn't been enough pressure from basically within the groups themselves compared with the pressures that other minority groups put on to get what they think they should have. Let me be very, very candid about this. I am not suggesting that in terms of any group that has not had an equal chance, that we should not make an all-out effort to rectify that situation, and we are. We're doing, frankly, a rather outstanding job in many fields with regard to minority groups. We're even making progress. I understand that the women are minority groups. I don't know, but they do all right. And like my family, stuff get any attention. That's been the experience of this country almost from the beginning. It's been particularly the experience during the 60s and the early 70s. I do not suggest that that individuals should under any circumstances just roll over and be nice guys and so forth and so on, after not complaining and not raise certain issues. I do not suggest that at all. I'm only stating the political reality. Is that whether you're dealing with the Congress against congressional action, appropriation, favor, bilateral program, or whether you're dealing with a government agency in terms of getting the proper slots, not just the menial jobs, but, and of course they are important too. Most of us, I didn't start with menial jobs, I think probably any of you did too. You don't live around in the yard, you really don't say $100
a day, man.
$100 a day? You can't afford to be in
find them. They are there.
The reason that they don't apply is that they think it's hopeless. That's the reason. But you appoint a few, and then they all start coming in. And that's for old outlying agencies, even Secretary Campbell in agriculture can do it. You have, but let me say that there are a lot of prestigious positions in the state of trade and in justice jobs.
And you're looking for lawyers, and you're looking for judges.
We're
needed. And that's the other point that I'm making.
I think the thing I want to get across to those who are the non-governmental people in this I urge this, just as I urge it with all of our minority groups, just as I urge it, for example, when the people representing the women's groups came in. We're not doing this just as a favor to you. This country at this present time is in a very, very interesting position now. I think this is probably a pretty good note for me to bring my remarks to close on, to put this at a level that we all understand. Understand what the stakes are. George Romney and I just had a little colloquy at the cabinet meeting, and this will take it off. We were talking about keeping America competitive. We were talking about the fact that we're pricing ourselves out of the world markets by wage price pushes and so forth. What are we going to do to make ourselves more competitive? How are we going to be more productive? Let me tell you how important it is. 25 years ago, the United States was number one in the world economically and militarily without any fear of any competition. 7% of the world's people 25 years ago in the United States produced over 50% of the world's goods. There was a dollar gap, and there wasn't anybody in the world that offered us any chance of competition. Whether it was automobiles or steel or anything else, we produced over 50% of the world's steel, mostly automobiles and the rest. We really had it. We didn't have to run very fast. We didn't have to be very competitive. We really didn't have to develop all the resources of our country. We didn't have to have all of the American people. The thing is that might be a Mexican-American, a Cuban-American, or a Puerto Rican, or a Black-American, or an Eastern European, as the case might be. It didn't matter whether that person who might have great leadership qualities was developed or not, because America was first, and so we can get along. In 25 years, the world has totally changed. By reason of our help, our former enemies, Japan and Germany particularly, are now our two main competitors in the free world. And boy, they are tough competition. And also, we find Western Europe, to whom we have given billions of dollars of aid to rebuild them after the war, very, very competitive with the United States of America. And with the 300 million people that will be in that common market, it will be a bigger trading area than the United States of America. It will be a kind of people that are like the people here. You'll ever go all the way in the end. Of course, Spain will get in as the rest of all of its great drive. And you're going to find those 300 million people really competing with the United States. They'll be our friends. Believe me, the toughest competition usually I find in the world is with our friends. So you've got Western Europe with 300 million competing. You've got Japan competing with us. And then, of course, we have the new openings. We are negotiating with the Soviet Union a number of areas. We're reducing, we think, the danger of confrontation war. We have the new openings in China. It doesn't mean that there aren't great differences between the United States. There will not continue to be great differences between mainland China and the United States, because our interests are different, our systems are different. But now we're going to talk about them. And by talking about them, negotiating about them, it may be that 20, 25 years from now, instead of having an inevitable confrontation with a huge nuclear power, we may have a negotiation, and that, of course, the stakes are high. But the other side of the coin is that as you open the Soviet and have more trade with them, as you open to mainland China and have more trade with them, that means the United States has another great competitor in the world. Take the Chinese as an example. There are 800 million of them. They are the most creative people, and probably, in terms of capacity, if you look at what they've done in all the countries of the world in which they operate, in Manila, in Hong Kong, in San Francisco, any place you want, the Chinese have an enormous capability, particularly in the business and economic field. And as they open up to them, have a new competitor again. All right, how does this all add up? The United States is still number one in strength. We're still number one in economic. And I think we can stay that way. But with the new players that are on this field, Western Europe inevitably will be breathing down our neck.
they're going to compete in hunger.
Japan, it is really garnering a number of fields. They've already run us out of the whole radio business. They're competing with us in the automobile business. There are a number of others. And of course, here's China, not at present a serious competitor, looking down the years it will be. And of course, the Soviet Union, potentially a competitor. And I haven't even mentioned the growing potential in Latin America, the growing potential in Africa, and so forth. Now, what did all this add up to? The United States at the present time, if we're looking to our children, the people who will be sitting around this table in this cabinet 25 years from now, whoever is sitting here and whoever is sitting with him or her who is in this chair will be representing the second or third strongest country economically in the world, unless America develops all its resources to the hills. In other words, we cannot afford any lease. That means we've got to develop the heartland of this country. That's why we're going out and developing rural America again, you know. That's what, because we've got to have the production. That's why we've got to be competitive in our business. That's why the government has to be slimmed down and made more efficient. Also, above everything else, we've got to develop the human resources of this country. There are only 200 million Americans. There are 800 million Chinese, 300 million Europeans, 150 million Japanese, and of course millions of others in the other parts of the world. It isn't numbers that really count so much as it is quality. But America cannot afford to have, using it, tens of millions of people in the, among the people of Spanish or Latin background, have them not operating up to their full capacity. In other words, the ideal of this country must be that every American, whatever his background, has an equal opportunity to develop to the full his capabilities. If he can be the best lawyer in town, he's got to have the chance to be that lawyer. If he's the man that can be the judge, he's got to have the chance to be the judge. If he's the man that can, in any government field, if he's the fellow that can be a GS-14 rather than a 13 or up the line or whatever, he's got to have that chance. Because we cannot afford to have any group in this society, any group in this country, not having their equal chance to develop their capabilities to the fullest. Now he comes back to government. Why does government have such a great responsibility? It has a great responsibility because, as far as the private sector is concerned, it, and this has always been true in our society, it does not move as fast in developing opportunities for promotion, et cetera, for what are called minority groups, as government can. Whether you look at the Eastern Europeans, whether you look at the Irish, whether you look at others through the years, their first move, significantly enough, was into government, and then later they developed a capacity in the private field. And so what we must do in government is to provide the opportunities that may not presently be available in the private sector. So they were going to push private enterprise and so forth to do their part. But what we must do in government is to make sure that here, where there are many opportunities, where is there is great need for great talent, that people who are represented so well by the non-governmental people around this room, where people like that have a chance, where they don't have the feeling, well, because I don't happen to be an Englishman, because I happen to be a Mexican-American, or a Puerto Rican, or a Cuban-American, I really don't have that equal chance. Well, that's going to change. It's either going to change, or the people in the personnel offices in every department represented around this table are going to change. But you've got to take initiative. I just close with this one thing. Don't wait. Don't wait. And this is said particularly civil service, said to every one of the cabinet. Don't wait till the wheels grease. Don't wait till they blow something up out of Los Angeles because they're, with justification, frustrated. But get out there and provide the opportunity so that there is not even one scintilla of a suggestion, not only that we are discriminatory, but I want to turn it around. I want to say that not only are we not discriminatory, but that we are making positive moves to rectify a situation in which an imbalance has occurred.
occurred because the groups involved have been law-abiding people who have just trusted, put their trust in the fact that in this country everybody is destined to get an equal party. Now that is true. There's a better chance in this country, and I conclude with this fact, than in any other country that I know, for an individual to get an equal break and to go to the top and to have his ability recognized. But I simply say that we in government have a great opportunity here. We've got an exciting, strong group of people, millions of them, who have great abilities, untapped abilities, who can make an enormous contribution to this country. It's our job to seek them out. It's our job to find them. It's our job then to promote them and to give them that chance. And if we can get that kind of a spirit around here, this will help. You're to follow up, Bob, and we're to follow up. Not only with this one meeting, we've made the little talk, we've made the pitch, and I've tried to make it before, but the only way it's going to work in the future is to have at other meetings of this group. I want to have reports, and I've already talked to everybody, I want to have reports from him, of course, and from you as the progress has been made. And also, we want reports as to what our failures have been. Because if they say that nothing happens here unless there is presidential backing, I think I have been quite clear as to where the president stands on this. We expect all of you to follow up. Thank you.
Success that will bring us out of some of the past.